fashion? Answer, no. DiCarlo had told me that Charlie preferred knives and swords to guns, because in the desert guns could be heard for a long distance. I asked DiCarlo if, among the guns at Spawn Ranch, Manson had a special favorite. Yeah, DiCarlo said, a high-standard 22-caliber buntline revolver. I showed him the gun and asked him, have you ever seen this revolver before? Answer, I saw one similar to it. Question, does it appear to differ in any fashion? Answer, the trigger guard is broken. Other than that? Answer, I can't be sure. Question, why can't you be sure? Answer, I don't know. I don't know the serial number of it. I am not sure that is it. DiCarlo had cleaned, cared for, and shot the gun. He had an extensive background in weapons. The model was unusual, and he had made a drawing of it for LAPD even before he was told that such a gun had been used in the Tate homicides. I'd already introduced the drawing for identification purposes over Kenrick's objection that it was hearsay. If anyone should have been able to make a positive identification of that revolver, it was Danny DiCarlo. He didn't do so, I suspected, because he was afraid to. Though he was a shade weaker on the stand than in our interviews, I did succeed in getting a tremendous amount of evidence in through DiCarlo. The court was interrupted for another 3-day recess. DiCarlo's direct took less than a day and a half of actual court time. I completed it on September 17th. That morning, Manson passed word through Fitzgerald and Shin that he wanted to see me in the lockup during the noon recess. Kenrick was not present, though the other two attorneys were. I asked Manson what he wanted to talk to me about. I just wanted you to know that I didn't have anything to do with the attempted murder of Barbara Hoyt, Manson said. I don't know whether you ordered it or they did it on their own, I replied. But you know, and I know, that in either case they did it because they thought it would please you. Manson wanted to rap, but I cut him off. I'm not really in the mood to talk to you, Charlie. Maybe, if you have enough guts to take the stand, we'll talk then. I asked McGann what was happening on the Honolulu hamburger case, as the papers had dubbed the Hoyt murder attempt. McGann said he and Calkins hadn't been able to come up with any evidence. I asked Phil Sartucci of the LaBianca team to take over. Phil efficiently turned in a detailed report with information on the airline tickets, credit cards, long-distance calls, and so forth. It was December, however, before the case was taken to the grand jury. In the interim, Uish, Squeaky, Clem, Gypsy, and Rice remained at large. I'd often see them with the other family members at the corner of Temple and Broadway. On cross-examination, Fitzgerald asked DiCarlo, "Is it not true that Mr. Manson indicated to you that he actually loved the black people?" Danny replied, "Yeah, there was one time he said that." On redirect, I asked DiCarlo about that single conversation. Charlie had told him he loved the blacks, he said, for having the guts to fight against the police. Shin brought out that DiCarlo was aware of and more than passingly interested in the $25,000 reward, thereby establishing that he had a reason to fabricate his testimony. Kenrick pursued the subject in detail in his cross. He also dwelt at length on DiCarlo's fondness for weapons. Earlier, DiCarlo had testified that he loved guns. Would he describe that love? Kenrick asked. DiCarlo's reply brought down the house. Well, I love them more than I do my old lady. It was easy to see where Kenrick was heading. He was trying to establish that it was DiCarlo, not Manson, who was responsible for all the weapons being at Spawn Ranch. Kenrick switched subjects. Wasn't it true, he asked DiCarlo, that during the entire time you were at the ranch you were smashed? Answer, I sure was. Question, were you so smashed that on many occasions you had to be carried to bed? Answer, I made it a few times myself. Kenrick hit hard on DiCarlo's drinking, also his vagueness as to dates and times. How could he remember one particular Saturday night, for example, and not another night? Well, that particular night, DiCarlo responded, Gypsy got mad at me because I wouldn't take my boots off when I made love to her. Question. The only thing that is really pinpointed in your mind that you really remember is that you had a lot of sex, right? Answer. Well, even some of that I can't remember. Kenrick had scored some points. He brought out that DiCarlo had testified on an earlier occasion, during the Beausoleil trial, that while at Spawn he was smashed 99% of the time. The defense could now argue that DiCarlo was so inebriated that he couldn't perceive what was going on, much less recall specific conversations. Unfortunately for the defense, Fitzgerald unintentionally undermined this argument by asking DiCarlo to define the difference between drunk and smashed. Answer. My version of drunk is when I'm out to lunch on the ground. Smashed is just when I'm walking around loaded. September 18th, 1970. That afternoon, we had a surprise visitor in court, Charles Tex Watson. After a 9-month delay that would necessitate trying him separately, Watson had finally been returned to California on September 11th, after U.S. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black refused to grant him a further stay of extradition. Sergeants Sartucci and Gutierrez, who accompanied Watson on the flight, said he spoke little, mostly staring vacantly into space. He had lost about 30 pounds during his confinement, most of it during the last 2 months, when it became obvious his return to Los Angeles was imminent. Fitzgerald had asked that Watson be brought into court to see if DiCarlo could identify him. Realizing that Fitzgerald was making a very serious mistake, Kenrick objected strenuously, but Older granted the removal order. The jury was still out when Watson entered the courtroom. Though he smiled slightly at the three female defendants, who grinned and blew him kisses, he seemed oblivious to Manson's presence. By the time the jury came in, Watson was already seated and appeared just another spectator. Fitzgerald. Mr. DiCarlo, you previously testified that a man by the name of Tex Watson was present at Spawn Ranch during the period of time that you were there in 1969. Is that correct? Answer. Yeah. Question. Do you recognize Mr. Watson in this courtroom? Answer. Yeah. Right over there. Danny pointed to where Tex was sitting. Obviously curious, the jury strained to see the man they had heard so much about. Fitzgerald. Could I have this gentleman identify himself for the court, Your Honor? The court. Will you please stand and state your name? Watson stood, after being motioned to his feet by one of the bailiffs, but he remained mute. Fitzgerald's mistake was obvious the moment Watson got up. One look, and the jury knew that Charles Tex Watson was not the type to order Charles Manson to do anything, much less instigate 7 murders on his own. He looked closer to 20 than 25. Short hair, blue blazer, gray slacks, tie. Instead of the wild-eyed monster depicted in the April 1969 mugshot, when Watson had been on drugs, he appeared to be a typical clean-cut college kid. Offstage, Watson could be made to seem the heavy. Having once seen him, the jury would never think this again. Since our first meeting in Independence, I had remained on speaking terms with Sandy and Squeaky. Occasionally, one or both would drop in at my office to chat. I usually made time for such visits, in part because I was still attempting to understand why they and the three female defendants had joined the family, but also because I was remotely hopeful that if another murder was planned, one or the other might alert me. Neither, I was sure, would go to the police, and I wanted to leave at least one channel of communication open. I'd had more hopes for Sandy than Squeaky. The latter was on a power trip, acting as Manson's unofficial spokesman, running the family in his absence, and it seemed unlikely she would do anything to jeopardize her status. Sandy, however, had gone against Manson's wishes on several occasions, I knew. They were minor rebellions. When her baby was due, for example, she had gone to a hospital rather than have it delivered by the family. But they indicated that maybe, behind the pat phrases, I'd touch something responsively human. On her first visit to my office about 2 months earlier, we'd talked about the family credo. Sandy had maintained it was peace. I'd maintained it was murder, and had asked how she could stomach this. "People are being murdered every day in Vietnam," she'd countered. "Assuming for the sake of argument that the deaths in Vietnam are murders," I responded, "how does this justify murdering 7 more people?" As she tried to come up with an answer, I told her, "Sandy, if you really believe in peace and love, I want you to prove it. The next time murder is in the wind at Spawn Ranch, I want you to remember that other people like to live just as much as you do. And as another human being, I want you to do everything possible to prevent it from happening. Do you understand what I mean?" She quietly replied, "Yes." I'd hoped she really meant that. That naive hope vanished when, in talking to Barbara Hoyt, I learned that Sandy had been one of the family members who had persuaded her to go to Hawaii. As I left court on the afternoon of the 18th, Sandy and 2 male followers approached me. "Sandy, I'm very, very disappointed in you," I told her. "You were at Spawn when Barbara's murder was planned. There's no question in my mind that you knew what was going to happen. Yet, though Barbara was your friend, you said nothing, did nothing. Why?" She didn't reply, but stared at me as if in a trance. For a moment I thought she hadn't heard me, that she was stoned on drugs, but then very slowly and deliberately she reached down and began playing with the sheath knife that she wore at her waist. That was her answer. Disgusted, I turned and walked away. Looking back, however, I saw that Sandy and the 2 boys were following me. I stopped, they stopped. When I started walking again, they followed, Sandy still fingering the knife. Gradually, they were closing the distance between us. Deciding it was better to face trouble than have my back to it, I turned and walked back to them. "Listen, you goddamn bitch, and listen good," I told her. "I don't know for sure whether you were or weren't involved in the actual attempt to murder Barbara, but if you were, I'm going to do everything in my power to see that you end up in jail." I then looked at the 2 males and told them if they followed me one more time, I was going to deck them on the spot. I then turned and walked off. This time they didn't follow me. My reaction was, I felt, exceptionally mild, considering the circumstances. Kenrick felt otherwise. When court reconvened on Monday the 21st, he filed a motion asking that I be held in contempt for interfering with a defense witness. He also asked that I be arrested for violating Section 415 of the Penal Code, charging that I had made obscene remarks in the presence of a female. September 21st to 26th, 1970. Finding nothing in Sandra Good's declaration that, in my opinion, constitutes contemptuous conduct on the part of Mr. Bugliosi, Judge Older dismissed Kenrick's several motions. Again, Manson asked to see me in the lockup during the noon recess. He hoped I wasn't taking all this, the attempted murder, the knife incident, the trial, personally. "No, Charlie," I told him. "I was assigned to this case. I didn't ask for it. This is my job." "By now it should be obvious to me," Manson said, "that the girls were acting on their own, that nobody was dominating them." When I raised a skeptical eyebrow, Manson said, "Look, Bugliosi, if I had all the power and control that you say I have, I could simply say, 'Brenda, go get Bugliosi,' and that would be it." It was interesting, I thought, that Manson should single out Brenda McCann, true name Nancy Pittman, as his chief assassin. Later, I'd have good reason to recall Manson's remarks. Nothing personal. But immediately after this, the middle-of-the-night hang-up calls began. They'd continue even after we changed our unlisted number. and several times when I left the Hall of Justice at night, I was followed by various family members, including Sandy. Only the first time disturbed me. Gail and the kids were circling the block in our car, and I was afraid they would be identified or the license number spotted. When I pretended not to see her, Gail quickly sized up the situation and drove around until I was able to shake my followers, though, as she later admitted to me, she was far less cool than she appeared. Though concerned with the safety of my family, I didn't take any of this very seriously until one afternoon when, apparently enraged at the domination testimony that was coming in, Manson told the bailiff, "I'm going to have Bugliosi and the judge killed." By telling a bailiff this, Manson was making sure we got the message. Older was already under protection. The next day, the district attorney's office assigned me a bodyguard for the duration of the trial. Additional precautions were taken, which, since they're probably used in protecting others, needn't be enumerated, though one might be noted. In order to prevent a repetition of the events at 10,050 Cielo Drive, a walkie-talkie was installed in our home, which provided instant communication with the nearest police station in case the telephone wires were cut. Though Older and I were the only trial principals who had bodyguards, it was no secret that several, if not all, of the defense attorneys were frightened of the family. Dae Shin, I was told by one of his fellows, kept a loaded gun in each room of his house, in case of an unannounced visitation. What precautions, if any, Kennerick took, I never learned, though Manson often assigned him top spot on his kill list. According to another defense attorney, Manson threatened numerous times to kill Kennerick. It was only fair, Manson supposedly said, since Kennerick was killing him in court. Manson at one point had Fitzgerald draw up papers for Kennerick's dismissal. According to Paul, who told the story to me, Kennerick literally got down on his knees and, with tears in his eyes, begged Manson not to fire him. Manson relented and, though they continued to disagree, Kennerick remained on the case. Each week, a member of the Los Angeles Board of Supervisors issued a press release itemizing trial costs to date. Yet even with Kennerick's multitudinous objections, many of which called for lengthy conferences, we were covering a tremendous amount of testimony each day. A veteran court reporter said he'd never seen anything like it in 20-odd years. Thus far, Judge Older had done a remarkable job of holding Kennerick in check. Had he granted even half the evidentiary hearings Kennerick was always calling for, the 10-year estimate might have become a reality. Instead, each time Kennerick made the request, Older said, "Put your motion in writing with supporting citations." Because of the time involved, Kennerick rarely took the trouble. For our part, although I'd originally planned to call some 100 witnesses, I'd cut that number down to about 80. In a case of this magnitude and complexity, this was a remarkably low number. Some days saw as many as a half dozen witnesses taking the stand. Whenever possible, I'd use a single witness for several purposes. In addition to his other testimony, for example, I asked DiCarlo the names and approximate ages of each of the family members, so it would be apparent to the jury that Manson, being older than all of them, was not likely to have played a subservient role. When I called Sheriff's Deputy William Gleason to testify that when Spawn Ranch was raided on August 16th, not one buck knife was found, Kennerick, seeing the implication of this, objected, and Older sustained the objection. I'd almost given up getting this in when Fitzgerald, apparently thinking the absence of such knives was a plus for the defense, asked on cross-examination, "Did you find any buck knives at the Spawn Ranch on the date of August the 16th, 1969? Answer? No, sir. The family's attempt to silence Barbara Hoyt backfired. Once a reluctant witness, she was now very willing to testify. Barbara not only confirmed Linda's story of the TV incident, she recalled that the previous night, the night of the Tate murders, Sadie called her on the field phone at the back house, asking her to bring three sets of dark clothing to the front of the ranch. When she arrived, Manson told her, they already left. Barbara's story was both support for Linda Kasabian's testimony and powerful evidence of Manson's involvement, and, though unsuccessful, Kenrick fought hard to keep it out. I was not able to bring out the Myers Ranch conversation until after a full half-day of argument in chambers, and then, as I'd anticipated, I could only get in part of it. One afternoon in early September 1969, Barbara had been napping in the bedroom at Myers Ranch when she awoke to hear Sadie and Uish talking in the kitchen. Apparently thinking Barbara was still asleep, Sadie told Uish that Sharon Tate had been the last to die because, to quote Sadie, she had to watch the others die. I got this in, finally. What I couldn't get in, because of Aranda, was the rest of the conversation. Barbara had also heard Sadie tell Uish that Abigail Folger had escaped and run out of the house, that Katie had caught up with her on the lawn, and that Abigail had struggled so much that Katie had to call for help from Tex, who ran over and stabbed Abigail. In chambers, Shin argued that he should be allowed to question Barbara about this. Older, as well as the other defense attorneys, strongly disagreed. By arandizing the conversation, omitting all references to her co-defendants, this put the onus for all five murders on Susan, Shin complained, adding, "But other people were there too, Your Honor." Bugliosi, "They were, Day?" Inadvertently, Shin had admitted that Susan Atkins was present at the Tate murder scene. Fortunately for both attorney and client, this dialogue took place in chambers and not in open court. As with the other ex-family members, I was able to bring in through Barbara numerous examples of Manson's domination, as well as a number of Manson's conversations about Helter Skelter. The one thing I couldn't get in was the family's attempt to prevent Barbara Hoyt from testifying. During his cross-examination of Barbara, Kenrick attacked her for everything from her morals to her eyesight. Aware that Barbara had very poor vision, Kenrick had her take off her glasses. Then he moved around the courtroom, asking how many fingers he had up. Question: how many can you see now? Answer: three. Kenrick: may the record reflect she said three and I have two up clearly, Your Honor. The court: I thought I saw your thumb. Kenrick finally proved Barbara had bad eyesight. The issue, however, wasn't her sight, but her hearing. She didn't claim to have seen Sadie and Uish in the kitchen at Myers Ranch, only to have heard them. Kenrick also asked Barbara, "Have you been in any mental hospital for the last couple of years?" Ordinarily, I would have objected to such a question, but not this time, for Kenrick had just opened wide the door through which I could, on redirect, bring in the murder attempt. Redirect is limited to the issues raised on cross-examination. For example, on redirect, I had Barbara approximate the distance between the bedroom and the kitchen at Myers Ranch, then conducted a hearing experiment. She passed with no trouble. Asking to approach the bench, I argued that since Kenrick had implied that Barbara Hoyt was in a mental hospital for an extended period of time, I had the right to bring out that she was in a mental ward only overnight and that it was not because of a mental problem. Older agreed, with one limitation. I couldn't ask who gave her the LSD. Once I'd brought out the circumstances of her hospitalization, I asked, "Did you take this overdose voluntarily?" Answer: no. Question: was it given to you by someone else? Answer: yes. Question: were you near death? Kenrick: calls for a conclusion, Your Honor. The court: sustained. It was good enough. I was sure the jury could put two and two together. On Saturday, September 26th, 1970, an era came to an end. A raging fire swept Southern California. Whipped by 80-mile-an-hour winds, a wall of flame as high as 60 feet charred over 100,000 acres. Burned in the inferno was all of Spawn's movie ranch. As the ranch hands tried to save the horses, The Manson girls, their faces illuminated by the light of the conflagration, danced and clapped their hands, crying out happily, "Helter Skelter is coming down! Helter Skelter is coming down!" September 27th to October 5th, 1970. Juan Flynn, who described his job at Spawn Ranch as manure shoveler, seemed to enjoy himself on the stand. Of all the witnesses, however, the lanky Panamanian cowboy was the only one who openly showed animosity to Manson. When Charlie tried to stare him down, Juan glared back. After positively identifying the revolver, Juan remarked, "And Mr. Manson on one occasion fired this gun, you know, in my direction, you see, because I was walking with a girl on the other side of the creek." It was difficult to stop Juan once he got started. The girl had come to Spawn Ranch to ride horses. She'd ignored Manson, but went off down the creek with amorous-minded Juan. Charlie was so miffed he'd fired several shots in their direction. Kenrick succeeded in having all this, except Juan's seeing Manson fire the revolver struck. He also tried but failed to keep out the two most important pieces of evidence Juan Flynn had to offer. One night in early August 1969, Juan had been watching TV in the trailer when Sadie came in dressed in black. "Where are you going?" Juan asked. "We're going to get some fucking pigs," Sadie replied. When she left, Juan looked out the window and saw her get into Johnny Swartz's old yellow Ford. Charlie, Clem, Tex, Linda, and Leslie got in also. According to Juan, the incident had occurred after dark, about 8 or 9 p.m., and though he wasn't able to pinpoint the date, he said it was about a week before the August 16th raid. The logical inference was that he was describing the night the LaBiancas were killed. Juan's story was important both as evidence and as independent corroboration of Linda Kasabian's testimony. Not only did the time, participants, vehicle, and color of Susan Atkins' clothing coincide, Juan also noticed that Manson was driving. Juan then testified to the kitchen conversation, which occurred a day or so later, when putting a knife to his throat, Manson told him, "You son of a bitch, don't you know I'm the one who's doing all of these killings?" The newsmen rushed for the door. Manson admitted murders, Spawn Ranch cowboy claims. Kenrick's objections kept out another piece of extremely damaging evidence. One night in June or July 1969, Manson, Juan, and three male family members were driving through Chatsworth when Charlie stopped in front of a rich house and instructed Juan to go in and tie up the people. When he'd finished, Manson said he was to open the door and, to quote Manson, "We'll come in and cut the motherfucking pigs up." Juan had said, "No thanks." This was, in effect, a dress rehearsal for the Tate-LaBianca murders. But ruling that the prejudicial effect far outweighs the probative value, Older wouldn't permit me to question Juan about this. I was also unable, for the same reason, to get in a comment Manson made to Juan. Adolf Hitler had the best answer to everything. That answer, of course, was murder, but owing to Kenrick's objections, neither of these two incidents was heard by the jury or ever made public. On cross-examination, Fitzgerald brought out an interesting anomaly. Even after Manson had allegedly threatened him, not once but several times, Juan still stuck around. After the raid, he'd even accompanied the family to Death Valley, remaining with them a couple of weeks before splitting to join Crockett, Poston, and Watkins. That had puzzled me, too. One possible explanation was that, as Juan testified, at first he had thought Manson was bullshitting about the murders, that nobody in their right mind is going to kill somebody and then boast about it. Also, Juan was easygoing and slow to anger. Probably more important, Juan was an independent cuss, like Paul Crockett, who didn't leave Death Valley until long after Manson threatened to kill him. He didn't like to be intimidated. Kenrick picked up on Fitzgerald's discovery. "Now, Mr. Flynn, were you scared to be at the Myers Ranch with Mr. Manson?" Answer: "Well, I was aware and precautious." Question: "Just answer the question, Mr. Flynn. I understand you were an actor, but would you just answer the question, please? Answer? Well, I liked it there, you know, because I wanted to think nice things, you know. But every time I walked around the corner, well, that seemed to be the main subject, you know, about how many times they could do me in. Then, finally, I just left. Question. Now, Mr. Flynn, will you tell me how you were aware and precautious? How did you protect yourself? Answer. Well, I just protected myself by leaving. Kenrick brought out that when Flynn was interviewed by Sartucci, he'd said nothing about Manson putting a knife to his throat. You were holding that back, is that it, Mr. Flynn? To spring on us in this courtroom, is that right? Answer. No. I told the officers about this before, you see. Ignoring Flynn's response, Kenrick said, You mean, Mr. Flynn, that you made it up for the purposes of this courtroom. Is that correct, Mr. Flynn? Kenrick was charging that Flynn had recently fabricated his testimony. I made a note of this, though as yet unaware how important this bit of dialogue would soon be. After focusing on all the things I had brought out which were not in the Sartucci interview, Kenrick asked Juan when he first mentioned the knife incident to anyone. Answer? Well, there was some officers in Shoshone, you see, and I talked to them. Flynn, however, couldn't recall their names. Kenrick strongly implied several times that Flynn was fictionalizing his story. Juan didn't take kindly to being called a liar. You could see his temper rising. Intent on proving that Flynn was testifying so he could further his movie career, Juan had had bit parts in several westerns, Kenrick asked, You recognize, do you not, that there is lots of publicity in this case against Mr. Manson, right? Answer, Well, it is the type of publicity that I wouldn't want, you big catfish. The court? On that note, Mr. Kenrick, we will adjourn. After court, I questioned Juan about the Shoshone interview. He thought one of the officers was from the California Highway Patrol, but he wasn't sure. That evening, I called the DA's office in Independence and learned that the man who had interviewed Juan was a CHP officer named Dave Stuber. Late that night, I finally located him in Fresno, California. Yes, he'd interviewed Flynn, as well as Crockett, Poston, and Watkins, on December 19, 1969. He'd taped the whole conversation, which had lasted over 9 hours. Yes, he still had the original tapes. I checked my calendar. I guessed Flynn would be on the stand another day or two. Could Stuber be in L.A. in 3 days, with the tapes, and prepared to testify? Sure, Stuber said. Stuber then told me something I found absolutely incredible. He had already made a copy of the tapes and given it to LAPD on December 29th, 1969. Later, I learned the identity of the LAPD detective to whom the tapes had been given. The officer, since deceased, recalled receiving the tapes but admitted he hadn't played them. He thought he had given them to someone, but couldn't remember to whom. All he knew was that he no longer had them. Perhaps it was because the interview was so long, 9 hours. Or perhaps, it being the holiday season, in the confusion they were mislaid. Neither explanation, however, erases the unpleasant fact that as early as December 1969, the Los Angeles Police Department had a taped interview containing a statement in which Manson implied that he was responsible for the Tate-LaBianca murders, and as far as can be determined, no one even bothered to book it into evidence, much less play it. Ordinarily, there would have been no way I could introduce the Stuber tape into evidence at the trial, for you cannot use a previously consistent statement to bolster a witness's testimony. However, there is an exception to that rule. Such evidence is admissible if the opposing side contends the witness's testimony was recently fabricated and the prior consistent statement was made before the declarant had any reason to fabricate. When Kenrick asked, You mean, Mr. Flynn, that you made it up for the purposes of this courtroom. Is that correct, Mr. Flynn? He was charging recent fabrication and opening the door for me to bring the prior consistent statement in. A lot of doors were opened on cross-examination, but at first the biggest did not look like a door at all. The defense had made much of the fact that Juan did not tell his story to the authorities until long after the events occurred. With this opening, I argued, I should be allowed to bring out the reason why. He was in fear of his life. Responding to Kenrick's objection, Older said, You can't go into all of these things on cross and expect the other side to do nothing about them, Mr. Kenrick. You can't paint them in a corner and say they can't work their way out. Juan was permitted to testify that he didn't go to the police because I didn't think it was safe for me to do that, you see. I got a couple of threat notes. Actually, Juan had received three such notes, all handed him by family members, the last as late as 2 weeks ago, when Squeaky and Larry Jones had discovered that Juan was living in John Swartz's trailer in Canoga Park. Arguing against their admission, Fitzgerald made an interesting statement. My life has been threatened three times, and I haven't come forward and talked about it. Bugliosi, has the prosecution threatened you? Fitzgerald, no, I am not saying that. He didn't elaborate. Older ruled that Juan could testify to the notes, though not the identities of the persons who gave them to him. Juan also testified to the hang-up calls, the cars that raced past in the night, their occupants oinking and screaming, motherfucker and pig. I asked him, and you considered these threats, is that correct? Answer, well, they sounded, you know, pretty strong to me. Question, are those among the reasons why you didn't want to come downtown and talk? Answer, well, this was one of the reasons, yes. Question, because of fear of your life? Answer, yes. When I asked about the other reasons, Juan described how Manson, Clem, and Tex had creepy-crawled Crockett's cabin at Barker Ranch. All of this came in because the defense so gratuitously opened the door on cross. Because Kenrick had questioned Juan about Manson's programming of family members, I was able to bring in a conversation Manson had with Juan in which he explained that he had to unprogram his followers to remove the programming placed upon them by their parents, schools, churches, and society. To get rid of the ego, Manson told him, you had to obliterate all the wants that you had, give up your mother and father, all the inhibitions, just blank yourself out. Since Manson's techniques differed depending on whether his subject was male or female, I asked what Manson had said about unprogramming the girls. I didn't anticipate that Juan would go into the detail he did. Answer, well, he says, you know, to get rid of the inhibitions, you know, you could just take a couple of girls and, you know, have them lay down, you know, and have them eat each other. Or for me to take a girl up in the hills, you know, and just lie back and let her suck my dick all day long. Kenrick, Your Honor, may we approach the bench, Your Honor? Earlier, one of the alternate jurors had written Judge Older a letter complaining about the sexual explicitness of some of the testimony. I didn't look at him, but I suspected he must be having apoplexy. As I passed the counsel table on the way to the bench, I told Manson, Don't worry, Charlie. I'm keeping all the bad stuff out. Older struck the entire answer as non-responsive. I asked Juan, Did Mr. Manson discuss with you, without going into what he said, Juan, plans that he had to unprogram the people in the family? When he replied, Yes, I let it go at that. What Manson never explained to his family was that in the process of unprogramming them, he was reprogramming them to be his abject slaves. Throughout his cross-examination, Kenrick had implied, as he had with many of the earlier witnesses, that Juan had been coached by me. I thought Kenrick was going to do this again for the umpteenth time, when on recross he started, Mr. Flynn, when a question is asked of you that you think may not help the prosecution in this case. Bugliosi, oh, stop arguing. Kenrick, Your Honor, he's interrupting. Bugliosi, be quiet. The court, Mr. Bugliosi, now I'm not going to warn you again, sir. Bugliosi, what's he doing, Your Honor? He's accusing me of something, and I don't like it. The court, approach the bench. Bugliosi, I am not going to take it. I've had it up to here. My indignation was as much a matter of trial tactics as anything else. If I let Kenrick get away with the same trick time after time, the jury might assume there was some truth to his charges. At the bench I told Older, I'm not going to be accused of a serious offense by this guy day in and day out. The court, that's absurd. You interrupted Mr. Kenrick. You made outrageous statements in front of the jury. I find you in direct contempt of court, and I fine you $50. To the amusement of the clerk, I had to call my wife to come down and pay the fine. Later, the deputy DAs in the office put up a buck each for a Bugliosi defense fund and reimbursed her. As with the earlier citation of Hughes, I felt if I was in contempt of anyone, it was Kenrick, not the court. The following day, for the record, I responded to the contempt, noting, among other things, that in the future I would ask the court to please consider two obvious points. This is a hotly contested trial, and tempers become a little frayed. And also take into consideration what Mr. Kenrick is doing, which incites a response on my part. With my citation, we now had a perfect score. Every attorney involved in the trial had been either cited for contempt or threatened with it. The defense tried their best to ridicule Juan's fear of Manson. Hughes brought out that since Manson was locked up, it was hardly likely he could hurt anyone. Did Mr. Flynn actually expect the jury to believe that he was afraid of Mr. Manson? Juan might have been speaking for all the prosecution witnesses when he answered, well, not of Mr. Manson himself, but the reach that he has, you know. By now, I could see the pattern. The more damaging the testimony, the more chance Manson would create a disturbance, thereby assuring that he, and not the evidence itself, would get the day's headlines. Juan Flynn's testimony was hurting him badly. Several times while Flynn was on the stand, Older had to order Manson and the girls removed because of their outbursts. When it happened again on October 2nd, Manson turned to the spectators and said, "Look at yourselves. Where are you going? You're going to destruction, that's where you're going." He then smiled a very odd little smile and added, "It's your judgment day, not mine." Again the girls parroted Manson, and Older ordered all four removed. Kenrick was livid. I just showed the judge the transcript pages where Kenrick accused Flynn of lying. Older ruled, "There is no question. There was an implied, if not express, charge of recent fabrication. Highway Patrolman Dave Stuber would be permitted to play that portion of the taped interview dealing with Manson's incriminating admission." Stuber had been investigating a stolen auto report, not murder, when he talked to Flynn, Poston, Crockett, and Watkins in Shoshone. However, realizing the importance of their story, he had spent over 9 hours quizzing them on their knowledge of Manson and his family. After the trial, I wrote a letter to the California Highway Patrol commending Stuber for the excellent job he had done. After establishing the circumstances of the interview, Stuber set up the tape recorder and began playing the tape at the point where the statement had begun. There is something about such physical evidence that deeply impresses a jury. Again, in words very similar to those they had heard him use when he was on the stand, the jurors heard Juan say, "Then he was looking at me real funny. And then he grabbed me by the hair like that, and he put a knife by my throat. And then he says, 'Don't you know I'm the one who is doing all the killings?'" Monday, October 5th, 1970. Bailiff Bill Murray later said he had a very strong feeling that something was going to happen. "You get a kind of sixth sense dealing with prisoners day after day," he said, noting that when he brought Manson into the lockup, he was acting very tense and edgy. Although they had made no assurances that they would conduct themselves properly, Older gave the defendants still another chance, permitting them to return to the courtroom. The testimony was dull, undramatic. There was at this point no clue as to its importance, though I had a feeling Charlie just might suspect what I was up to. Through a series of witnesses, I was laying the groundwork for destroying Manson's anticipated alibi. LASO Detective Paul Whiteley had just finished testifying, and the defense attorneys had declined to cross-examine him when Manson asked, May I examine him, Your Honor? The court. No, you may not. Manson. You are going to use this courtroom to kill me? Holder told the witness he could step down. Manson asked the question a second time, adding, I am going to fight for my life one way or another. You should let me do it with words. The court. If you don't stop, I will have to have you removed. Manson. I will have you removed if you don't stop. I have a little system of my own. Not until Manson made that very startling admission did I realize that this time he wasn't play-acting, but deadly serious. The court. Call your next witness. Bugliosi. Sergeant Gutierrez. Manson. Do you think I'm kidding? It happened in less time than it takes to describe it. With a pencil clutched in his right hand, Manson suddenly leaped over the counsel table in the direction of Judge Older. He landed just a few feet from the bench, falling on one knee. As he was struggling to his feet, Bailiff Bill Murray leaped too, landing on Manson's back. Two other deputies quickly joined in, and after a brief struggle, Manson's arms were pinned. As he was being propelled to the lockup, Manson screamed at Older, "In the name of Christian justice, someone should cut your head off." Adding to the bedlam, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten stood and began chanting something in Latin. Older, much less disturbed than I would have expected, gave them not one but several chances to stop, then ordered them removed also. According to the bailiffs, Manson continued to fight even after he had been taken into the lockup, and it took four men to put cuffs on him. Fitzgerald asked if counsel might approach the bench. For the record, Judge Older described exactly how he had viewed the incident. Fitzgerald asked if he might inquire as to the judge's state of mind. The court. He looked like he was coming for me. Fitzgerald. I was afraid of that, and although... The court. If he had taken one more step, I would have done something to defend myself. Because of the judge's state of mind, Fitzgerald said, he felt it incumbent upon him to move for a mistrial. Hughes, Shin, and Kenrick joined. Older replied, It isn't going to be that easy, Mr. Fitzgerald. They are not going to profit from their own wrong. Denied. Out of curiosity, after court, Murray measured the distance of Manson's leap. 10 feet. Murray wasn't too surprised. Manson had very powerful leg and arm muscles. He was constantly exercising in the lockup. Asked why, he'd once told the bailiff, I'm toughening myself up for the desert. Murray tried to recreate his own leap. Without that sudden shot of adrenaline, he couldn't even jump up on the counsel table. Though Judge Older instructed the jury to disregard what you saw and what you have heard here this morning, I knew that as long as they lived, they'd never forget it. All the masks had been dropped. They'd seen the real face of Charles Manson. From a reliable source, I learned that after the incident, Judge Older began wearing a .38-caliber revolver under his robes, both in court and in chambers. Judgment Day. Echoing Manson, the girls waiting outside on the corner spoke of it in conspiratorial whispers. Wait till Judgment Day. That's when Helter Skelter will really come down. Judgment Day. What was it? A plan to break out Manson. An orgy of retribution. As important was the question of when. The day the jury returned their verdict of not guilty or guilty? Or if the latter, the day the same jury decided life or death? Or perhaps the day of sentencing itself? Or might it even be tomorrow? Judgment Day. We began to hear those words more and more often, without explanation. As yet unaware that the first phase of Judgment Day had already begun with the theft from Camp Pendleton Marine Base of a case of hand grenades. October 6th to 31st, 1970. Some weeks earlier, on returning to my office after court, I'd found a phone message from attorney Robert Steinberg, who was now representing Virginia Graham. On the advice of her previous attorney, Virginia Graham had withheld some information. Steinberg had urged her to give this information to me. Specifically, the phone message read, "Susan Atkins laid out detailed plans to Miss Graham concerning other planned murders, including the murders of Frank Sinatra and Elizabeth Taylor." Since I was very busy, I arranged to have one of the co-prosecutors, Steve Kay, interview her. According to Virginia, a few days after Susan Atkins told her about the Hinman, Tate, and LaBianca murders, probably on November 8th or 9th, 1969, Susan had walked over to Virginia's bed at Sybil Brand and begun leafing through a movie magazine. It reminded her, Susan said, about some other murders she had been planning. She had decided to kill Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, Susan matter-of-factly stated. She was going to heat a knife red-hot and put it against the side of Elizabeth Taylor's face. This was more or less to leave her mark. Then she'd carve the words Helter Skelter on her forehead, after which she was going to gouge her eyes out. Charlie had shown her how, and Virginia interrupted to ask what Richard Burton was supposed to be doing during all this. "Oh, both would be tied up," Susan said. "Only this time the rope would be around their necks and their feet, so they couldn't get away, like the others." Then, Susan continued, she would castrate Burton, placing his penis, as well as Elizabeth Taylor's eyes, in a bottle. "And dig this, would you?" Susan laughed. "And then I'd mail it to Eddie Fisher." As for Tom Jones, another of her intended victims, she planned to force him to have sex with her at knife point, and then, just as he was climaxing, she would slit his throat. Steve McQueen was also on the list. Before Susan could explain what she had in mind for McQueen, Virginia interrupted, saying, "Sadie, you can't just walk up to these people and kill them." "That would be no problem," Susan said. "It was easy to find out where they lived. Then she'd simply creepy-crawl them, just like I did to Tate." "She had something choice for Frank Sinatra," Susan continued. "She knew that Frank liked girls. She'd just walk up to his door and knock. Her friends, she said, would be waiting outside. Once inside, they'd hang Sinatra upside down, then, while his own music was playing, skin him alive. After which they'd make purses out of the skin and sell them to hippie shops, so everyone would have a little piece of Frank." She had come to the conclusion, Susan said, that the victims had to be people of importance, so the whole world would know. Shortly after this, Virginia terminated the conversation with Susan. When asked by Steve Kay why she hadn't come forward with the story before this, Virginia explained that it was just so insane that she didn't think anyone would believe her. Even her former attorney had advised her to say nothing about it. Were these Sadie's own plans, or Charlie's? Knowing as much as I did about Susan Atkins, I doubted if all this came from her. Though I had no proof, it was a reasonable inference that she had probably picked up these ideas from Manson. In any case, it didn't matter. Reading a transcript of the taped interview, I knew I'd never be able to introduce any of this in evidence. Legally, its relevance to the Tate-LaBianca murders was negligible, and whatever limited relevance it did have would be outweighed by its extremely prejudicial effect. The Virginia Graham statement was useless as evidence. A copy of it was made available to each of the defense attorneys under discovery. It would soon make its own kind of legal history. Although it was Ronnie Howard who first went to the police, I called Virginia Graham to the stand first, since Susan had initially confessed to her. Her testimony was unusually dramatic, since this was the first time the jury had heard what had happened inside the Tate residence. Since their testimony was only against Susan Atkins, only Shin cross-examined Graham and Howard. His attack was less on their statements than their backgrounds. He brought out, for example, 16 different aliases Ronnie Howard had used. He also asked her if she made a lot of money as a prostitute. Asking him to approach the bench, Older said, "You know the rules, Mr. Shin. Don't give me that wide-eyed innocent stare and pretend you don't know what I'm talking about. Shin, does Your Honor mean I cannot ask a person their occupation? The prosecution had made no deals with either Virginia Graham or Ronnie Howard. Howard had been acquitted on the forgery charge, while Graham had served out her full sentence at Corona. In both cases, however, Shin did bring up the reward. When he asked Ronnie if she knew about the $25,000, she bluntly answered, "I think I am entitled to it." On redirect, I asked each, "Are you aware that testifying in court is not a prerequisite to collecting the money?" Objection. Sustained. But the point was made. The letters Susan Atkins had written to her former cellmates, Ronnie Howard, Joe Stevenson, and Kit Fletcher, were very incriminating. Although I was prepared to call a handwriting expert to testify to their authenticity, Shin, in order to save time, stipulated that Susan had written them. However, before they could be introduced in evidence, we had to arandize them, excising any references to Atkins' co-defendants. This was done in chambers, outside the presence of the jury. Kenrick fought to exclude almost every line. Disgusted at his constant objections, Fitzgerald complained to Older, "I don't have the rest of my life to spend here." Older, equally disgusted, told Kenrick, "I would suggest that you use a little more discretion and not try to clutter up the record with motions, objections, and statements which any 10-year-old child can see are either nonsense or totally irrelevant." Yet time and again, Kenrick pointed out subtleties the other defense attorneys missed. For example, Susan had written Ronnie, "When I first heard you were the informer, I wanted to slit your throat. Then I snapped that I was the real informer, and it was my throat I wanted to cut." "You don't inform on yourself," Kenrick argued. "You confess." This implied that other people were involved. After 19 pages of argument, much of it very sophisticated, we finally edited this particular section to read, "When I first heard you were the informer, I wanted to slit your throat. Then I snapped that it was my throat I wanted to cut." Kenrick wanted the line, "love, love, love," excluded from the Stevenson letter because it refers to Manson. The court, "It sounds more like Gertrude Stein." Since the love references were among the few favorable things in Susan's letters, Shin fought to retain them, remarking, "What do you want to do? Make a killer out of her?" Liz Sinatra on Slay List. The Los Angeles Herald Examiner broke the story on October 9th in an exclusive article bearing the byline of reporter William Farr. Learning the night before that the story was going to appear, Judge Older again ordered the windows of the jury bus covered so the jurors couldn't see the headlines on corner newsstands. Farr's article contained direct quotes from the Virginia Graham statement, which we had turned over to the defense on discovery. Questioned in chambers, Farr declined to identify his source or sources. After observing that under California law he could not order the reporter to do so, Older excused Farr. It was obvious that one or more persons had violated the gag order. Older, however, did not press the issue, and there, it appeared, the matter rested. There was no indication at this time that the issue would eventually become a cause célèbre and result in the jailing of Farr. Prior to his questioning by Older, Farr told Virginia Graham's attorney, Robert Steinberg, that he had received the statement from one of the defense attorneys. He did not say which one. Greg Jacobson was an impressive and very important witness. I had the tall, modishly dressed talent scout testify in detail to his many conversations with Manson, during which they discussed Helter Skelter, The Beatles, Revelation 9, and Manson's curious attitude toward death. Sharok Hatami followed Jacobson to the stand to testify to his confrontation with Manson at 10050 Cielo Drive on the afternoon of March 23, 1969. For the first time, the jury and the public learned that Sharon Tate had seen the man who later ordered her murder. In Rudy Altobelli, Kenrick finally met his match. On direct examination, the owner of 10,050 Cielo Drive testified to his first encounter with Manson at Dennis Wilson's home, and then, in considerable detail, he described Manson's appearance at the guest house the evening before he and Sharon left for Rome. Extremely antagonistic because Out the Belly had refused him permission to visit 10,050 Cielo Drive, Kenrick asked, "Now, presently, the premises on Cielo